We turn our attention back to Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse number 15 is where we're going to start. Remember that Deuteronomy is Moses' final address to the Israeli people. He's trying to cram in as much review for his students of the past 40 years as he can before he passes away and they go on into the Promised Land. So we have a lot of shifts in topic that happen in this book of Deuteronomy. At verse number 15, we talk about slavery. Now remember that the slavery of biblical times tended to be that brought about by economic problems, as in somebody gets in debt, they can't pay what is owed, and so they end up becoming a slave. There were others that did become slaves because of war action, and the losing side had to pay reparations to the winning side, and often that included people becoming slaves because of being on the losing side. But the Jewish people, their understanding from the book of Deuteronomy, from the book of Exodus and Leviticus, what God was passing on to them through Moses, was that the Israelis would never allow any fellow Israeli to be enslaved for an indebtedness longer than a maximum of 6 years, because it would be tied in to the work cycle. 6 years of work followed by a seventh year of rest, and the beginning of that seventh year of rest included the zeroing out of any debt owed by an Israeli, and therefore they were freed from their indebted slavery. The non-Israelis that were enslaved because of their indebtedness could be kept over the seventh year of release. But as I already told you, my suspicion was that an awful lot of those foreign nationals would have declared their willingness to convert to faith in the one true God and thereby become Israelis and be released from their indebtedness. And so I think that mindset, that attitude, is related to what we're about to read here in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 15. Ready? Here we go. You shall not give up to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. So this is clearly not about Israelis moving from one tribal region to another. This is about people coming into the boundaries of Israel from elsewhere. And the rule was, you don't return that slave into their slavery somewhere else. Instead, verse 16 says, he shall dwell with you in your midst, in the place that he shall choose within one of your towns, wherever it suits him. You shall not wrong him. So that sounds to me as if they are coming to Israel to seek not just simply freedom from their servitude elsewhere, but they're also looking for a long-term relationship with the Israeli people and with the God of Israel, the Creator God, and would want to become worshipers of He who is. Now, I can't help it. When I read this passage here, I am immediately reminded of our own sad history here in these United States. When we became an independent nation, we had a constitution that was put in place that had, in my opinion, too many compromises regarding the institution of slavery. And the slavery we had here in the colonies, followed by the slavery we had here in early American history, was not about indebtedness. except for the ones that were indentured servants. I'll talk about them in just a moment. The slavery we had here was brought on by the kidnapping of free peoples in another continent and bringing them here and treating them as animals to be sold and bred for the convenience and use of people living here in North America. And I'm not going to pull any punches about it. It was wrong. It was sinful. In fact, we've looked over the Israeli laws on such things. If you kidnapped and enslaved someone, that was a capital crime. You could be executed as a slaver, and you could even be executed as a slaveholder or a trafficker, because to deprive someone of their freedom without justification is a capital crime. It is a sin. The indebtedness that happened in coming to North America, we called it indenture, indentured servitude. A lot of those people were, to put it mildly, taken advantage of. They had their passage here paid for with a promise that they would remain servants into that system for as long as it took to pay back that cost plus some. And we are all, I think, shamefully aware as Americans that often they were caught up in a system where they could never get out of that indebtedness. And again, it was wrong. It was sinful, shameful, should not have happened. But the point that I was getting at is that our Constitution permitted the continuation of slavery from the colonial period into the early American history period. We had the slave, the Refuge Slave Act that was put in place that required those living in parts of America that did not approve of or practice slavery, they were required to send escaped slaves back to their masters. And I'm going to be, again, honest with you. I think that was wrong. I think it was morally atrocious that that was made a law. That 1790-something law was redone in 1850 to strengthen it. And that is really what kicked off the Underground Railroad, where Northerners who were devoted to helping enslaved people from the South escape that horrible situation, they didn't want to cooperate with the Fugitive Slave Act. The 1850 redo of it basically put very severe penalties against anyone that tried to cooperate in helping these people escape. And so that's why tens of thousands of black slaves escaped, not just simply through the northern states, but into Canada, far out of the reach of even the federal government that was keeping this immoral law going. And then, of course, you know the rest of the story is that it took our Civil War and the post-war acts or post-war amendments like the 13th Amendment to do away with the last vestiges of our constitutional system that not just simply permitted slavery, but protected this immoral practice. So very strong thoughts on that. I'm not going to back off of that that presentation. Here is a good passage in the book of Deuteronomy to remind people that the natural state that we should help people attain to is freedom. not being held in slavery in perpetuity, especially in a kidnapped state had happened here in North America. Verse number 17 in Deuteronomy 23 moves to another topic. None of the daughters of Israel shall be a cult prostitute, and none of the sons of Israel shall be a cult prostitute. Now, this is something for our modern Western minds, hard for our modern Western minds to get wrapped around. In the ancient world, the worship of pagan deities, gods and goddesses, was often facilitated with the opportunity to sleep with someone of whichever gender you wish to sleep with as part of an act of worship to that god or goddess. These were the cult prostitutes, both male and female, that were on duty in the temples and shrines of these gods and goddesses. Of course, Israel was being warned, when you go into the promised land, there's going to be a lot of this garbage that's going on there right now, which is why God is kicking them out and bringing you in. Don't pick up the same sort of practices. That means you should not be putting your sons and daughters on the payroll of some temple to a god or goddess that the worshipers want to come and have sexual activity with. It's just wrong. Verse 18, related to that, you shall not bring the fee of a prostitute or the wages of a dog, which in this context is a euphemism for the male cult prostitute. You shall not bring their wages into the house of he who is your God in payment for any vow, for both of these are an abomination to he who is your God. Now, it is weird to us to understand that the prophet Moses, being directed by the Holy Spirit, has some understanding that future Israelis are going to blow all of these prohibitions off. And they will have temples and shrine complexes devoted to other gods and goddesses. And they will have cult prostitutes, male and female, associated with those sites. And so as an additional prohibition, Moses says, and don't you dare bring as an offering to God the money that these types of people get as some sort of peace offering to God. Because the Israelis will, some of them, adopt this polytheistic attitude in the future, where, yes, God is God Most High. He is the greatest of all gods, and he is due worship at the temple building for all of the things that he's done. But he's not the only God. There's other gods and goddesses. They're lower down on the scale than him. And so God does not want tithes or offerings that come out of service to other gods and goddesses. That's just not right. Change of topic. Verse number 19. And we've seen this a couple of different times now in the other law passages. You shall not charge interest on loans to your brother, interest on money, interest on food, interest on anything that is lent for interest. Now, the idea of interest here, we have another term that gets used, usury, which just is a fancy term for a usage fee, a cost or a charge for borrowing money. Now, the understanding that we've seen in the other passages is that Israelis are supposed to be looking out for one another because they come from the same family. Even though the nation is much larger now, you know, in the time of Moses, and people don't really remember all the familial connections with specificity, they are all related. And family should not charge family whenever they fall on hard times and need some help. And so no interest fees are to be charged Israeli to Israeli when somebody falls on hard times and needs some help. Now, verse 20 says, you may charge a foreigner interest, so you can charge them use fees, but you may not charge your brother interest, that he who is your God may bless you in all that you undertake in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. So they are to be kind and considerate of family members that fall on hard times. This is related to when Jesus is talking about refuse no one who asks of you. Give to them. Because it's a family matter. They've fallen on hard times. You are nearby to them, and you have the wherewithal to help. And so it's a family member asking a family member for help. Now, Jesus, I think, would also expect for us to take in consideration all the other passages where sometimes you have to practice tough love with family members. And so I always remind everybody of the New Testament teaching from the Apostle Paul that says, if someone doesn't work, neither should he eat. That's actually related to a proverb that says that a lazy person's hunger will drive him to work. It will make him go out and do what he can do to pay his own bills. And so there's the balance that needs to be understood here. But in the context that we're at right now, the context that Jesus was speaking to, we're talking about someone who probably through no real fault of their own is in trouble. And you don't look at them as a means of lining your own pockets. Now, a little thought about the foreigner here. Just because the permission was given to the Israelis to charge usage fees for money lent to a foreigner doesn't mean it had to be assessed against those that were falling on hard times. I mean, after all, they are a human being, and they are also related to you, maybe not through Jacob, but certainly through Noah and Mrs. Noah. And so you ought to have a little mercy, as Jesus taught, mercy, blessed are those who show mercy because they shall receive mercy. Jesus also said, do unto others as you would have them do unto yourself. And so I think that even though usury fees are permitted here, it doesn't mean that permission to do the other person in is acceptable to God. A reasonable fee, a reasonable interest is appropriate. Verse number 21, change of topic. If you make a vow to he who is your God, you shall not delay fulfilling it. For he who is your God will surely require it of you, or you will be guilty of sin. So the idea that if you, in the name of God, promise something. Now, typically, the context here has in mind promising something to God. Like, God, I promise that when I sell this cow or when I sell this field, I'm going to give half of the proceeds to you. If those words pass out of your mouth, then you are bound by them. That's what's being taught here. And that is why you are warned here as an Israeli, and by extension, these are principles that I think we can live by today. You are warned to think twice maybe thrice, maybe many times before you make such a vow. Verse 22. If you refrain from vowing, you will not be guilty of sin. You shall be careful to do what has passed your lips, for you have voluntarily vowed to He who is your God what you have promised with your mouth. And so this is certainly related to what Jesus taught and to what James, his half-brother, also taught, that you should not be making vows in the name of the Lord. You should let your yes mean yes and your no mean no. Anything beyond that is actually, you know, in the area of the evil one. Now, both James and Jesus were saying these things, writing these things in relationship to the Pharisaic practice of fiddling around with vows, that it only counted if it was phrased in a very specific way. And only the Pharisee leaders apparently understood the fine points of that wording. And so they were able to do the loophole thing. But Jesus and James were basically warning, don't make promises. Don't make vows in the name of the Lord unless you're going to keep them exactly as you said you would. And so I would say that's a very good principle for all of us. Don't make promises that you can't for sure keep. And so having learned from repeatedly teaching this passage, I have become much more likely to say, I'll try, or I'll do my best when asked by someone to make them a promise or make them a guarantee. Because, as James himself said, you don't know what tomorrow has. Those people that say, today or tomorrow we're going to go to this city or that city, we're going to make a big profit, you don't know that. So be careful how you speak things out of your mouth, because you need to keep the promises. Verse number 24, change of topic. If you go into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat your fill of grapes, as many as you wish, but you shall not put any in your bag. If you go into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the ears with your hand, but you shall not put a sickle to your neighbor's standing grain. Now this, very Jewish, very Israeli, is a reminder that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Now I think the more precise translation for that should be, the land is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. The Israeli covenant communicated the understanding that all of the promised land belonged to God. The Israelis received allotments within that land, referred to as inheritance, and on those allotments they raised crops, and they were expected to pay 10% of the increase every year into God's coffers. They were tenant farmers. So the actual land didn't belong to them. It was on loan to them. And now we also understand the crops didn't belong to them either. They belonged to God. And so God gave permission to all Israelis, when you're traveling around and you get hungry, you have permission to eat what will satisfy your hunger from any crop that happens to be at the ready. So if you're going through a vineyard, feel free to grab off a little cluster of grapes and eat them to satisfy your hunger. If you're going through a grain field, which we actually have an example of this in the Gospels of the Apostles. You're going through a grain field, get a little peckish, Feel free to snap off some of the heads of ripe grain, you know, rub them between your hands to get the husks off, blow that chaff away, and munch away on the kernels. Perfectly acceptable. But do not go in there and start harvesting it. That is against the rules. Because the person whose inheritance that is, that's their prerogative to harvest that property and that crop. And so don't be stealing their hard work. Now, how do we do with this today? Well, we don't have the same laws today. So don't be grabbing apples in the orchard that you're walking past and think you're good to go. That is inappropriate. Now, if the fruit's hanging over the fence, I'm not sure how American law deals with that. Things out in the wild, a little bit more familiar with that. That's fair game. But the idea for the Israelis is clear. The earth, the land is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And don't be stealing from the hard work of your neighbors. Chapter 24, verse 1, is another change of topic. And it's a big, important topic that we're going to have to go to the New Testament and talk about. So we're just barely going to introduce it as we're closing up today. When a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house, ... because that's where we're going to have to stop. The New Testament has a big argument going on about what the word indecency in this context means.